Hold up your right hand and look at it. Imagine it to be half its size, no muscle, paralyzed. The tendon in your forearm pulls your hand toward you so that your elbow is bent and paralyzed. For all practical purposes, your hand and arm are useless. You won't be able to find a wife or have a family. You cannot make a good living. Luke did not name me in his book. I am only known as the man with the shriveled right hand.
One of the most heartbreaking yet uplifting stories in the New Testament is about the man with the withered hand who was healed by Jesus. An overwhelming account, incredibly meaningful to countless followers through the ages.
Every time someone meets you, they stare at your deformity. Little kids make fun of you. It seems as if nobody has ever wanted to be your friend. The nerves in your hand are in such excruciating pain that you cannot sleep at night. Life is so hard, you want to die. The one place I should have been able to find relief from my troubles was at the synagogue, where you would think people would have treated me with compassion. Instead, many of the leaders there wanted to exclude me from all activities. My deformity violated the meeting requirements in the Pharisees' interpretations of the law of Moses. Life was worse on the Sabbath, much more than on any other day of the week. My life was miserable at best, and I didn't think it could get any worse. Then I met Jesus, and it got worse, miserably worse. I was hiding in a corner of the synagogue at Capernaum, trying to overhear the teachers and rabbis as they questioned Jesus. I could tell they were enemies of his, but I couldn't tell why. His reputation among the people was favorable. If I could ever get through the crowds, I hoped someday to ask him to heal me. I could not bear the thought of them driving him away from Capernaum. I was almost lost in my thoughts when my world changed. Jesus stood up, pointed to me, and said, "Get up and stand in front of everyone." With that one command, he embarrassed me more than I thought possible. Everyone there knew who I was and what my deformity was. I thought he might angrily command me to leave the synagogue. If he had, I might have just kept on walking into the Sea of Galilee and killed myself. In a haze, I just stood up in front of them all. Jesus looked with fury, but not at me. He looked at the Pharisees and teachers of the law and asked, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?" When they wouldn't respond because of their hard hearts, he got even angrier, and turning to me, he commanded, "Stretch out your hand." I don't know how to describe what happened next so that you can comprehend it. My right hand and arm seemed to rise in the air on its own. And as I reached out, the tendons creaked like old springs. The muscles grew in size. And my hand was healed. The pain was gone, and I could stretch and grip the fingers as well as I could in my left hand. I was instantly and completely healed. I fell to my knees in worship and thankfulness. Not only was my hand healed, but my life was made whole too. But what was good for me was not so good for Jesus. From that day on, the Pharisees and other religious leaders considered him public enemy number one. Some of them even started talking of ways to kill him. Unlike me, They were not used to being embarrassed and powerless. They were not used to people questioning and disobeying their man-made rules, and they didn't like it. For the next several weeks, I followed Jesus as best I could. The crowds were usually so thick around him that I had to listen from a distance, but I'd been healed. So I knew it was only fair that others get a chance to be healed too. What I wasn't prepared to see was that Jesus not only healed people physically, he healed them spiritually too. One day, we walked across a large level spot. Jesus was in the lead, followed closely by the 12 apostles, then by his other disciples, and then trailed by a huge crowd of people coming from hundreds of miles away. Everyone wanted to hear him teach, and many were hoping to be healed from their disease or demon possession. Everyone wanted to touch him. He had such power coming from him. I want to pause for a moment to help you understand something you have probably never thought about. Even with the good Roman roads, most country people in the world rarely traveled outside of the areas of their home villages. Making a living was a full-time job, and I don't mean a 40-hour work week. And you didn't get time and a half. Most of us had no reason to travel. The Jews, however, were different from all other groups of people. In his wisdom, God had set up various festivals and religious rites that required his people to travel long distances and stay in the houses of strangers. We were very used to that. Our society was designed to feed and house travelers on an informal and regular basis. More importantly, we were used to being in crowds and behaving well in crowded situations. This was typical behavior in Israel, but not in the vast countrysides of the Roman Empire. When Jesus was in Galilee, he attracted crowds who could follow him. This would not have been possible in most societies. I mean, what do you think it was like for a person like me to be in a crowd following Jesus? I had to count on the kindness of strangers to feed me and find a place to stay. I had to find a way to wash my clothes and bathe and use the bathroom. I had to get used to the noise, smells, and shoving of the crowds. All of that was doable early in Jesus' ministry, but the size of the crowds soon began to overwhelm the informal systems in place. Jesus stood on a rock overlooking the crowd, and we came to an immediate halt and hush. And although he was looking at and talking to his close disciples, his voice carried so far that everyone in the crowd could hear him. He talked of things that none of us could make sense of. The crowd looked totally bewildered. We were like lost sheep. Jesus said that those of us who are poor, hungry, dejected, rejected, and excluded are blessed. He said that we should rejoice if we are that way because our reward in heaven is great. And then he warned about being rich, well-fed, happy, or socially well-off. Honestly, it was crushing for him to say that because we didn't understand how that was possible. We had always been taught that good people were rewarded in life. So if we were disadvantaged, it meant we were bad people. Jesus was transforming everything about the way we should look at the world and ourselves. And he was just getting started. He said that we should love our enemies and do good for those who hate us. After having lived with so many enemies and people who hated me, I didn't see how I would ever get there. But that was just the start. He wanted us to do to others as we would have them do to us. Now, that was a terrifying twist on an old message. We had long been taught not to do to others what we didn't want them to do to us. That actually was a fairly easy thing to do. But Jesus wanted us to act in an entirely different way. We were stunned and couldn't understand, even if we had a lifetime to do it. But Jesus wasn't through. He told us in matters of judging, condemning, or forgiving and giving, that we will receive just what we give. He told us to be careful about trying to guide others when we don't even know how to go ourselves. And then he said that we can evaluate others by their actions, not by their words. We weren't sure how to assimilate it all, but it did give us a new way to think about our religious leaders. They condemned us when we could not follow even the silliest of their little regulations. Yet they went about in fine clothing while spouting all sorts of religious words that they didn't follow themselves. We finally had the right to judge them by their actions while remaining faithful to the scriptures ourselves. Jesus let us know that our long-held resentments against them were justified. Our worldview was rocked. Jesus talked for a long time that afternoon. And I suspect nobody except Matthew can remember everything he said. But like a good preacher, Jesus would repeat the key parts of his message from time to time so different audiences could hear the important things he had to say. Some of us followers would get to hear his messages more than once. And as you know, I'm not a scholar, but I'm not stupid. For the rest of my life, I remembered these two things from that day. A righteous life is not about following men's rules, but being obedient to God. And being obedient to God is about loving God and loving people. I want to end my story by repeating a story Jesus told that afternoon as he finished speaking. You may not be able to tell, but many times when Jesus told a story, the audience could tell exactly who and what he was using as an object lesson. When he started a story with, "There was a certain man who," you could probably see him looking at one man in the audience or could identify that certain man with somebody everyone knew. Everyone also knew that Jesus had been a builder. Now, you might think of Jesus as just a carpenter, but that understates his skills. He was skilled in masonry and construction as well. It was important to have all types of construction skills because of the varied soils, building materials, and climates of Israel. As we had been listening to Jesus talk, we could see solid volcanic rocks around him that were perfect for building structures, much like the houses and synagogues in the surrounding towns. As I remember, Jesus told his story this way. There was a certain man who built a house. He began by digging a deep and expensive foundation that rested on solid rock. And then he built a solid rock house. When a flood came, the torrent struck the house, but could not dislodge it because it was well built. Another man built a solid rock house, but without any foundation at all. When the flood came, the torrent struck the house and it collapsed and was completely destroyed. And when he'd finished that part of the story, the entire crowd nodded in agreement. We completely understood what Jesus was saying. The second man was certainly foolish, and everybody could see it. Building your house without a solid foundation was certainly a foolish thing to do. But nobody in the audience was prepared for the application Jesus had for his story. We were still puzzled over much of what he had said in the previous hour. Jesus paused and looked over the crowd so that each of us felt like that certain man. And then he said, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? The one who hears what I say and puts it into practice is like that first man. His thoughts are built on solid ground, and they will withstand the test of life. The one who hears what I say and does not put them into practice is like the second man. His life will be destroyed." The crowd was in shock. We were used to our teachers pretending like they knew what they were talking about. but we were not used to someone speaking with such authority. We sat there, stunned, silent. We knew we had just heard a man of God speak. What we didn't know was that we had just heard the voice of God himself. Have you ever wondered what happened to the many people who Jesus healed? What did the former blind men do, the lepers or the deaf? A few of us were qualified to do even humble jobs, and few of us had any family or friends to help us out. I don't know about most of them, but let me give you a possibility of what happened to me. I knew that the fishing company owned by Peter, Andrew, James, and John was shorthanded, since the four of them had gone to follow Jesus. I desperately wanted to spend my time around people who could tell me more about Jesus. And now that my hand was healed, well, I applied for a job to Zebedee, the father of James and John. Catching a few tilapia from the Sea of Galilee would never be enough to satisfy those boys ever again. Zeb was kind enough to take me on, and I was thrilled to know I would never have to give up the job. I had become a fisherman, but the four apostles, they had become fishers of men. And with some experience, I would soon become Zeb's right-hand man.